Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
The passage that we're looking at here today is the doubleheader of Achrimot and Kedushim, covering Leviticus 16 through 20. And we picked up a number of passages there in Ezekiel 22 and chapter 20, and also in the companion passage there in Amos chapter 9, and the passages we looked at in 1 Corinthians 6 and Matthew chapter 5. So one of the things that we take a look here, we just kind of look from a top view down. Well, it seems like as you go through this passage, it's a gigantic grab bag of instructions. But when you actually see, there's a couple of key points that is in this particular passage of Leviticus 16 through 20. One of which first is to elevate, you know, to elevate your worship and behavior from those of the nations around you. And that's what you see in Leviticus 17, because they were to present their korbanot, or their offerings, the things which approach. They're not to be going out to the goat demons anymore, and they're not to be drinking the blood anymore. Now, I hope you noticed that, in a sense, Leviticus 17 and Leviticus 16 with the Yom Kippur Day of Atonement are like mirror images of each other, because they're saying, you know, when you are seeing goat offerings, that's not goat demons anymore. This is not Seir here. This is not what is going on. Rather, look at this. Look at the example of these two goats. Really reflect upon what is going on with this. And also about drinking blood. I mean, there's all kinds of cultures that have this thing, and you can understand it quite logically. In fact, even in Leviticus 17, and we saw at the beginning chapters of Leviticus, it goes over this as well. The life is in the blood. Pretty obvious. You cut somebody's arteries open, you know what quickly happens if something isn't done. They die. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if a lot of blood goes out of a person, it's correlated with them dying. So people figure that out pretty quickly. So that association of life being in the blood, pretty easy association to make. So that's when you're saying in a pagan practices that you would have this idea of drinking the blood of whatever your offering is or of your kill, so that you thus are partaking in the life of the animal. That's, and in taking various traditions, we'll take this to be you are taking in, whether it be some sort of earth goddess or something or other, into yourself, but through the blood of whatever animal that you are killing. So thus, you can see where the drinking of blood is associated with taking in the life of the person. So you're like, no, that is not something that people do. That is something where, what, you spill the blood out, or you take the blood to very specific places, either beside the altar, on the horns of the altars, or as you see in the Day of Atonement, you're sprinkling it in particular directions toward the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, that is where the life is going to a very specific thing. So it should have been ringing lots of bells in people's ears when Yeshua said what in the Gospel of John? Drink my blood, eat my flesh. I mean, that there was a lot of warnings. And so thus, when people are saying, hey, human sacrifice, passing your children through the fire to Molech, that should get people that were cringing at the ideas of idolatry and the ways of the nations, they would recoil from such a thing because those were in the instructions. We just read them, that these were in the instructions. You don't go there. Don't go there. The other nations are going there. You don't go there. But when you have these kinds of things and you see the admonitions from Yeshua about eating my flesh, drinking my blood, that should make you think back to the offerings. And the offerings are representatives of things that are going on. They are patterns, the patterns that were shown to Moshe on the mountain of the things that are going on in heaven. And you see the admonitions that come through the prophets. And Psalm 51 is an example, that you don't desire the blood of bulls and goats, but a contrite heart. And then you see the admonitions in the prophet Yeshayahu, first chapter of Isaiah, you know, that you don't, he says, I don't want these things. I hate them. Well, does he hate them? No, he calls for them. But if you're just thinking you're going to treat me like you treat the nations and just think, hey, I present this and everything is good, it's just an automatic transaction, you know, you deposit and get a withdrawal. You deposit the offering and you get the withdrawal of the blessings. No, heaven is not like a transaction here. It is something that your heart has to be involved with it in the totality of who you are, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, all of it is going into this. In modern parlance, you know, you have to be present when you're there in the presence of the Lord. So when the Lord is showing up, you have to show up too. Really, you're not just going through the motions. You are there too, because heaven is making this connection with earth. So you should be there making the connection as well. I mean, we see that in families too, about, you know, the father not present. They may be there, but they've checked out, or they're thinking about something else, or more obsessed with something else, or something is dragging them away, their thoughts, their attentions from their family. So these things that we see among everyday people, these things are also happening vertically in relationships with the creator of heaven and earth. So then also that we see that's another theme of all this passage of Achrimot and Kedushim, Leviticus 16 through 20, is respect. Respect the Lord's boundaries and those of others. Respect the boundaries that the Lord has. We call that holiness, what makes things separate from something else, that you need to make a distinction between the tahor, the things that can approach the presence, and the tameh, the things that are unfit to approach the presence of the Lord. You make that distinction. You just don't waltz in there. That's one of the first instructions that we see in Leviticus 16, which is riffing back on Leviticus 10 with the death of Aharon's two sons. And, you know, one of the things that we discussed at that point in time is that it could have been that they desired to have this connection. That could be that was riffing back to the encounter that the two sons had up on the mountain. They wanted it again. But the point is that the Lord was saying, no, it doesn't work that way. You just can't waltz in as you are because of your position as the sons of Aharon and as priests. A part of the Yom Kippur offering is what? For themselves and for their family. They need to offer it for themselves. Because, yes, they have been made holy. And remember the high priest? He's got this crown on it that says what? Holy to the Lord on it. So they are holy, made distinct, set aside for their particular purpose. But that is not just like an office that you hold. I am the holy one. And so thus, because of my office, then I can just go where I want. I got my all access card, my multi-pass. I can just go in there and click it on any particular entry door and just go right on in whenever I want to. But that's the point of what this instruction is. It's like, realize who it is you're working for. And it's not just because of who you know, but it's because of who you are and that relationship that you have with who you know. Because, I mean, you see that can happen in human relationships. It's like, well, you think just because I know somebody, I can just go on and do whatever. No, there's got to be respect. There's got to be a bit of elevating your own actions beyond that of just whatever you feel like. And that's also wrapped into that elevating whatever you feel like doing is also a key part of that icky chapter 18 with all of those nasty relationships, which also is reiterated in chapter 20 with all those nasty personal relationships that people have. Now, that is what you could say if you were to sum up chapter 18 and chapter 20. It's like, don't behave like an animal. That's what animals do. They're just like, in, you know, as it is, like mating season, you got to put your hand over the kids' faces when you go to the zoo. Well, because that's what animals do. When mating season comes in, the pheromones start flowing and things happen because that's what animals are designed to do. But we are made in the image of God. We're not animals. We share lots of characteristics, but we are not animals. That is one of the key distinctions of it. And in fact, one of the instructions that they have for relations with animals that go too far, that's the best way to put that, is that a woman is not to, and it says approach, it really in Hebrew, it's the word for, meaning go on all fours. You don't behave like an animal. Do not behave like an animal. But what do we see in the world today is a gravitation back to behaving like an animal. We see that with violence, with just relations, do whatever with whoever, whenever, to the point where you see whole cultures, like in Japan, where that is just, they've lost interest with interpersonal relationships because of it's become, in a sense, a bit meaningless and their reactions to it. So, yes. Oh, yes. First, start with Christine, then Sean. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yes, go ahead.
When I was brought to Torah, that was the thing that has stuck through me through all these years, is every day that decision, am I going to act like a beast? You know, first it showed up in appetite, but then, you know, it's the nefesh is appetite, intellect, you know, power, and this procreation, all of that territory. And so I just every day have to make that decision. Am I going to be in the image of Elohim, or am I going to be, you know, in the image of the beast, which is for me how I've studied 666, like both man and beast were created on the sixth day. What are you going to do about it? So this was really excellent how you brought those two chapters up, like, am I going to act like a beast? You know, and so thank you for that.
Yeah, because when we look at these things, when you talk about appetite, it's like we have all of these taste buds. So what are you to conclude from that? When we're talking about the creator of heaven and earth. He wants us to taste stuff. And those taste buds can taste different things. So he wants us to have a wonderful experience as we're tasting things. And we've got, you know, our olfactory bulbs, which are just fantastically well designed. You know, so much so that they even use quantum mechanics and how they work in being able to detect so many different chemical compounds and be able to distinguish between them. You know, you think about chefs or sommeliers or stuff like that who are able to train themselves to distinguish various smells of all kinds of different chemical compounds. So we are built for sensations, but what do we do with those things? Are we master over them? You know, what is it that's actually in control of us? And that's one of the distinctions between us and the animals, is that our ability to communicate, to have a relationship with our creator, and also to master our impulses. And we work with animals to teach them to control their impulses. Some species works better than others in your ability to train them in certain ways of it.
St. Helena and Calistoga joined up, just happened to go in, and of course they're looking at the Old Testament. And it's all about Jesus with those guys, because he's easy to deal with. He's a friendly guy, the way they see it. So anyway, and I was allowed to speak, and I got right in there, and I said, you know, God had quite a job, as I've mentioned before. You know, the Persians I had read recently were marrying mothers. You could marry your mother. Of course, we know the Phoenicians were busy burning babies so they could get notched up, and gosh knows what else, where Moses came from and everything. And I go, I simplified it, and I go, the one true God, and it paid off. He did it. He pulled it off to bring us Jesus. Mm. And they were kind of quiet at that point. But, you know, that Old Testament, he couldn't have pulled it off if he said, don't do that or I'm really going to get mad at you. You know, killing was not uncommon then. So no. You're going to die if you do that. And you do it, you're dying. And so this was not out of the realm. And if we could have done any better, surrounded by, and they were heathens as well, idol worship. You think we could have done better without the killing part?
Yeah.
I don't think it would ever pulled off. You couldn't have pulled that off because it looked like it worked.
Yeah.
Our God is a great God. The one true God out of that little tribe.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. Tammy, go ahead, please.
Yeah. Speaking on Alex's point a little bit later on, when the British occupied India, the Indians had a tradition of burning their widows. There were no such thing as widows in India. The husband died, the widow was killed in his pyre, okay? So, and that's regardless of her age or her health or anything. So if you had like a 60-year-old man die and he had a 10-year-old wife, guess who went in the funeral pyre? It's cruel, horrible. And so the British, when they came along, they say, oh, you have a tradition of burning your widows. Okay, well, we have a tradition of hanging people who burn their widows. And so it put a stop to that real quick. So it would be nice if you could simply rebut evil like that with just, you know, laying out the law and just saying it's not kosher to be burning your children or burning your widows. But you have to have teeth behind it that saying don't do that. You have to have some kind of teeth behind that. And if you don't, then oftentimes people will just keep on doing what they're doing. So it's a, you know, how would you say that? Strength through the death penalty, but yeah, tough love. Yeah.
Tough love. Yes. Sean, go ahead.
Just recently, I was thinking about how back in yesteryears, I'd hear the message of people, man, them Israelites, and, you know, how weak they were, and this and that and the other thing. I mean, he's addressing in the readings about Moloch. There are Elohims at play in here, been at play in their flesh, and that's one of the things like that infuriates me. It knows how to get in and affect the neurons and the hormones and all that, and it likes to fester and magnify it. That's just one thing I've personally experienced, and I'm definitely seeing out with people I'm working with. It just, it really well said about who am I going to master today, and being aware and taking every thought captive to the obedience, as if not, man, it'll sideswipe you. I mean, it's got a software and a program of its own, a robobotting, just continuing, just bombarding at our minds. And a lot of times, if you go on autopilot, that's a dangerous place.
Yeah. And, you know, if you've had any thing, challenges within your particular families of those who have some sort of mental distress or one way or the other, you know, to be able to work with somebody to get through that, to sort those ideas out, whether they be simple sort of challenges that people have, or, you know, you have some people that have really just messed themselves up with the chemical onslaught and they have to get through that. So, yes, you get that picture of this is the ideal that you're supposed to be able to master your interactions with the environment and interactions with other people. Yeah, not be a be under control of the puppet master. But that is a in previous times we've gone over this particular question of, you know, why do you need to celebrate the Day of Atonement since Yeshua atoned for our sins? We've covered this in more detail in previous years through this, but just a little bit of a recap on this. We got a lot more details if you go to that hallel.info/P29-30, you'll see these studies that we've done on this particular topic. But just in brief, that followers of Messiah Yeshua have really struggled to understand what this practice, why it's still important going forward. You know, traditional Judaism has struggled with this. What do you do with Yom Kippur if you have no temple? What do you do with that? So a liturgy is developed with it, and you've seen the Yom Kippur service that has developed to take the elements that we've just read about in Leviticus 16, but bring them into a time period where there is no temple. So you have the prayers that are, you know, taking the place of the things that the high priest is particularly doing. But really, the bottom line of it is that, just like we were mentioning with the life is in the blood, well, then how much more is the Day of Atonement something that the believers in Yeshua as the Messiah, as the Christ, as the anointed one of Israel, how much more then is this memorial of Yom Kippur something that is truly relevant? Especially we're going through in our Romans study, and we're really hitting it hard here in chapter 7 of Romans, and that's all in the aspect in chapter 6 and chapter 7 of you have now faced up to the fact that you cannot save yourself in God's eyes. So you need someone to cover you, to cover your sins, transgressions, and iniquities, to declare you not guilty, just like we read there in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, to justify you. So thus, it really is telling us the why of Yom Kippur and why believers should still really focus on this. So actually, let's take a look now. And speaking of this particular topic, to take a look at our passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. So what we see is it's really an outgrowth of Leviticus 19. And Leviticus 19 it's often called the holiness chapter, the holiness code, because every one of these little lines, what does it end with? Be holy. I am the Lord your God. So, goes again and again and again. It keeps saying this. So when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 20, what we really see is it is one of those examples of the heaven's prescription for guilt, shame, and it's also a prescription for being holier than thou, of thinking, oh, well, at least I'm not like this schlub over here. So I'm not as bad off as he is. Because that old saying that goes, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, is really what is in play in what the Apostle Paul is getting at. Because in this particular passage, that when he's saying, just as a bit of a recap on this, let's see, just take a look back at this particular passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It says here, or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. And it goes on, lists a long list of characteristics. So you think, well, okay, unrighteous. Well, the great unwashed. Well, really, in a sense, we're the unwashed. Before heaven grabbed us, called us in, we were the unwashed. But as the apostle is talking about, that we have been, like in verse 11, it says, such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Yeshua Mashiach and in the Spirit of our God. So just taking a look first at that first word there that's unrighteous in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9. It comes from the Greek word of adikos, and adikos is translated as, you know, descriptive of one who is violates or has violated justice. So you could say a criminal, we might say. And we think, well, we all are criminals. We were criminals when we were first picked up by God's call. God called out, calling us back. And just like you see there in Romans chapter 7, we face up to God's standards and we are criminals against the standards of God. Well, what does he do? Does he leave us in that? We're just like a pig just wallowing down in the mire and just so happy rolling around in the mud. Does he leave us there in the mud? No. He takes us out, as we get the picture of the washing of it, washing off all of that muck. And we get down to verse 11 of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and it talks about being justified. So where we first had adikos, here we have dakeo, which is the other side of it. Just like, and if you remember all those great mnemonics when you were learning language and stuff, that since a lot of our words have Greek derivations for it, you know, we have an a and or an a that goes in front of it. It's like the opposite of what the word is. So with the chaos for justified, and a couple of different lexicons, like Thayer has it, to declare, pronounce one to be just, righteous, or such as he ought to be. Whereas the BDAG lexicon has it as to cause someone to be released from personal or institutional claims that are no longer to be considered pertinent or valid to make free or pure. That's something, as we've been going through in the Roman study, that is, it can sometimes take a real big adjustment for us. That when they says that heaven has justified us, has declared us not guilty, that means it's gone. Remember that new covenant prophecy there in Jeremiah 31, that he will forgive, send away your iniquities. Like Yom Kippur, the goat, or Azazel, send it off. And remember them no more. So that goat that carried it away, gone. So we have the Mashiach, does two roles, covers sins, transgressions, iniquities, and carries off and away. takes them away from us. You know, such that we see that the word of dakeo, as it goes over into the Hebrew Bible, and that comes from the word of, you might recognize it, of tzedek, or for a tzaddik, one who is a righteous one. So that's how the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible translates tzedek, is with this word dakeo. So you see in that particular thing an example of that, like Noach. It says that Noach was righteous in his generation. And we see, well, there were some questionable things that happened with Noach's life, especially after the flood. But he was declared to be righteous in that generation. Not for how fantastically wonderful they are. Yes, Tammy has a comment or a question over here.
It got me thinking about that podcast that you and I were actually listening to on the way to church this morning, where they made the point about how holiness is not synonymous with sinlessness.
Right.
Just and I think we often make that apart. Mistakes when we see, we get confused when it says like certain people were righteous, like Lot. It's like he was righteous like you. And then you read about what happened after, you know, Sodom, and it's like, that's not righteous. But so, because we see the sin, but sinlessness and holiness are not the same thing.
Right. Holiness that, you know, we're one of our sections here is called the Kedoshim. It just means set apart. Kadosh just means set apart from something for something else, which when we were talking just a Torah passage or so back about, and we included the passage in of Acts chapter 10, that's a whole part of what that's referring to. It's like these, and also with the passage there in the Leviticus 13, where it's talking about the clean and unclean animals, that it is talking about what is fit to approach the presence of God and unfit to approach the presence of God. Not necessarily just because of what they are. Yes.
I believe it's in John, after the blind man got healed, I think it was, where he asked who did this to him, and the Pharisee got all indignant and says, "You were born in sin and in shape into iniquity." I believe that's what he says, right?
Right.
Right. So for a while, it took me a minute to think about that. And then it took me back to Genesis 6. We have these fallen watchers that have come and left their first estate. We have been touched by these less than favorable entities, you know, and we've reacted from the implanted thoughts and stimulation from, yeah, it makes sense that we're born into this thing. I thought that kind of interesting.
But. Yeah. But, you know, we're not powerless against these particular powers. That's one of the things that is a prefiguring of it with when we go through the Passover remembrance, is that this was basically a humbling of the powers that were over the people of Egypt, that they were subject to them, and they reveled in them. But one of the goals in this was, can you people of Egypt see who's really in charge here? Here you have the one that your servant population is following, the so-called, you know, goat herders and shepherds, the unwashed in the views of the Egyptians. We see that in the interactions that Yosef had with them, was that these people kind of live in the wilds, about with beards and with hair, into a population where it's quite noted in their writings that they removed hair And you can understand why in some of the hygienic times that hair can have all kinds of challenges with, wildlife that can, microscopic wildlife that can have issues with that. But you have the idea of cleanliness was in a part of the Egyptian culture, and removing all the hair was something that's reflected in their writings as a sense. What is that old saying? You know, cleanliness is next to godliness. Well, for there is hairlessness is next to godliness. So one of the things that we are looking at with this particular passage of 1 Corinthians chapter 6 is that we used to be in this particular position. We used to have behaviors. We used to be in this particular lifestyle, one or the other. We all have our backgrounds, the things that we came from. So when we have been called out of this and covered, those sins, transgressions, iniquities covered, considered, declared not guilty of those things, and move forward, well, how do you then live? You see on just the human analogy of this with someone who's dragged in before a judge, and they perhaps get some leniency from the judge. Well, what is going to happen just on human terms, just speaking purely in human terms here, what is going to happen when the person's behavior just continues on as it was after they've been given leniency before the court? Return to court. Yes, they'll return to court. And will the judge be happy with that as it was before? But that's on human terms. Now we see how much more then is the mercy that's been shown to us when we, in our proverbial situation, have been back to court many, many times in the views of heaven. But in each of those times, we're like, we go back and we say, as it's recorded there in 1 John chapter 1, it's like, we are not, after we leave that particular adjudication of our case in heaven, where heaven has stamped us as not guilty, and we leave. Heaven's purpose for us is not to continue on that path anymore. But if we do, we have an advocate for us, an advocate that speaks to us for heaven, and that is in the Mashiach. That will take who we were and have it be gone. And if those things happen again, we go back to our advocate. But the point is to not continue on down that particular path, because that is a path that we've been saying ever since we had our first garden experience with the two trees. There's the tree of life, and then the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Now, we don't need to go back to that tree anymore, the tree of knowledge of good and bad, because one of the things that heaven teaches us is that that way, it doesn't have a future. It will only lead away. So one of the important elements that we get to in this particular chapter of Leviticus 19 is what we commonly call the second greatest commandment. Because what's the greatest commandment? Well, the Shema, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. So in this particular one, you see in the Gospels when they're asking Yeshua about, you know, what's the greatest commandment, this one is talked about in there as well. And you will love your neighbor as yourself. But one of the things that you see in this is that you look at the whole part of what this instruction is. In Leviticus 19, verses 17 through 18, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You shall surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now remember, when you see these quotations from the Torah and the prophets in the Gospels and in the apostolic writings, always look at what the context is around it, because the context around it helps you understand what the whole role of this particular quotation is about. And also, you know, they are memory jog elements for people. We're talking about a culture that would know the scriptures pretty well, so that you just mention a little portion of it and you can remember the rest of it. Our country used to be like that too. If you look back at the writings of the founders of this country, there are Bible scriptures just peppered throughout it. They don't have quotations or citations thrown in. It's just thrown in there, and people who know the Bible would know where it's from, what the larger passage is, the context of it. So, and that's just in this particular country. You know, we're talking about in Israel, where you would be learning the Torah on a more particular basis. These little notes and references for it would pull up a much larger and much more rich and much fuller passage in your mind. And this particular passage, as you see here, this I am the Lord signature statement here in Leviticus 19 starts out, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. We have a word for that. We call it malice. You will not have malice against your fellow countrymen in your heart. You will not have a seething hatred that will come out either overtly or what we may say is passively aggressively, where you just look to undermine somebody and just kind of take a dig at them. But it's very interesting that that's paired together. Okay, you will not have malice against your countrymen in your heart. You will surely reprove your neighbor, meaning, you know, offer, hey, you're headed in the wrong direction. Because why? You will not incur sin because of him. And you see, the prophet Ezekiel gets at this same idea when he's talking about, yeah, you know, the soul, the one who sins, dies. But if you don't take the initiative to say, hey, you're headed in the wrong direction, you're almost complicit in the person heading off the rails. But you see it also taken into this, you shall not incur sin because of him, letting him just go off on, headed off the cliff. But you shall not take vengeance. You shall not bear a grudge against the sons of your people. And it's very interesting because that it's actually termed there in Hebrew as you will not guard. Basically, hold on to something. Guard it like a fortress. You've got this thing, this malice against somebody, and you just guard it. You won't let it go. You just keep on with it, and it just festers and festers and festers. So you will not just keep hold of this thing that you have against some other people, but you will love your neighbor as yourself. So remember that this is organized together in a section here that's been talking about what? Day of Atonement. So remember what Yeshua told his students, and you see Peter even come back. It's like, am I supposed to forgive him 7 times? Do I have to forgive him 7 times? Yeah, 70 times 7, at least that many times. Why? Because heaven has done that for us. You know, we remember that little analogy we were looking at of going into court. Well, how do you think a judge would feel if you showed up in the same court 490 times, the same court with either the same offenses or worse ones, 490 times. Yet, if heaven is willing to say, if you turn back, the sins, the transgressions, iniquities, out, gone, away from you, and heaven won't remember those anymore. So if heaven is willing to do that for you, well then, what should we do with other people? So that love your neighbor as yourself. So as heaven is willing to discharge this, to let it go, to not keep it in some heavenly lockbox of secrets about you, but to actually purge those out, to do a, as we call it, like a clean delete or a secure delete, and where you actually write over it many, many times so there's no way you could possibly ever recover it. If heaven's willing to do that for us, then what do we do with those things that happen against us from other people? So first Larry and then Christine. Go ahead.
I guess it's obvious, but you know, since seven is a number of completeness,
yes,
he's actually saying forgive him forever.
Yes. Yes. That's a good point. Yes, Christine.
I was, of course, thinking of Yeshua's parable about the servant that was forgiven a debt, and then that servant went out and beat people who owed him a debt as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that came to mind.
Yeah. So when this is where it's coming together, it's like when it talks about don't take this personal vengeance. It says vengeance is mine. Leave it up to the ones who can actually do something about it. To, you know, as we have in our society today, you've got authorities. If it needs to go up that far, hand it off to them to deal with it. And not hold on to it yourself. And as we go on here further with this about reproving your neighbor, how does this really help against that holier-than-thou tendency that we may have? Well, if you go to reprove somebody, it's like, what do you mean? Who are you to be coming after me to tell me, hey, you're headed in the wrong direction? So one of the issues that we have to then look at is that, like Yeshua talked about with his the speck versus the log in your eye, you need to deal with these things yourself. If you've got something against other people, you need to deal with it. If you've done something about things, you need to deal with these things so that you're not just looking at other people with the proverbial log in your eye, to looking for the specks in their eyes. So look at what heaven has done in having mercy on you, and then Yeshua says, then you'll be free to see, hey, heaven has had mercy on me. Maybe I can help being part of heaven's having mercy on other people, because to help them say, hey, you're going in the wrong direction, I have reached forgiveness. Just like heaven has forgiven me, heaven can forgive you as well. You know, turn back from the direction you're going in, because I turned back from the direction I was going in. So that's a part of the helping yourself avoid the holier-than-thou syndrome of thinking, well, you were just above everybody else and just looking down upon them. Now, who can we really look down upon? If heaven has had so much mercy upon us, who can we really look down upon? Those that heaven could turn around on a dime to turn back. Yes, Christine.
Again, I was thinking of the time when Yeshua was at the Pharisee's house and the woman with the alabaster jar.
Yes.
And asking, you know, who is more, oh, I can't forget. So in other words,
who loves more?
Yeah,
yes.
Those who have been forgiven more will love more.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Indeed. Larry has a comment or question over there.
Sorry, I'm being vociferous today. But one of the things that I've often thought about that when people say, well, you just think you're better than I am. I say, no, I think I'm worse because I know when I do things wrong. You may be ignorant of this. So I'm not being holier than you. I'm actually worse than you are.
Yeah. That just genuine concern for other people. This is really what the second greatest commandment, when you see it in the context of Leviticus 19, that's what it's talking about. It's just genuine concern for other people. Yes.
Yeah, it sounds a little off the track, but like Christine was saying, I want to resonate with she's talking about the beast, that humanity in us that's always there. Well, you know, Yeshua allowed this woman to wipe his feet with hair, and a woman's hair, especially in the Middle East, letting her hair down.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, and Yeshua, it's very personal. And Yeshua did have women around him. And that's for us to deal with. I mean, thank God. The world would not be a nice place for me if there was no beautiful women to look at.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to deal with all this.
Yes, we do.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Because, you know, let's just
stay away from them. I think he made it too. He went the monastic route. I can't do that, as Yeshua said. Some of you guys can't do that.
Yes. Some people are called to different realms of life. Yeah. Oh, Pat, go ahead, please.
One of the things about forgiveness that you learn over time is forgiveness isn't just for the person you forgive.
Mm.
Forgiveness is for you to help set you free from what you're holding on to so that you don't carry it anymore. And
Indeed.
When you forgive, truly forgive people, you no longer hold that in your heart.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's a great way to end it here today. So one of the things that we look at with this particular passage, it may just seem like a really strange combination of topics here together with Yom Kippur and then, you know, goat sacrifices and drinking blood, and then two icky chapters, you know, sandwiched in between, you know, a holiness code. You're like, but when you look at it all together, you're saying, hey, the Lord created them in the image of God. He made them. Male and female, he made them. You're not an animal. The Creator made the animals, and he made them fantastic because he said, and they were good. But, and mankind, very good. Being able to have a connection with heaven, have a connection with the Creator. And even when the very good creation decided to do an incredible affront and say, no, we don't need your knowledge of good and bad. We're going to go find it ourselves. So instead of going to the source of life for that knowledge, decided to go after it ourselves. And even to the front of, you know, as is expressed by the Apostle Paul in Romans 1, to worship the creation of the Creator rather than the Creator himself, and seek for wisdom and knowledge from those aspects, the elemental aspects that the Creator made, rather than going to the Creator himself. So even with all of that, heaven is willing and wants to dwell in the midst of the people, as it we saw in the passage today, in the midst of your impurities, but not leave you wallowing in the muck, but clean up, wash away your impurities, and send them away and remember them no more. Not drag them into some future conversation to throw in your face again. No, to remember them no more. even if you show up again in the same place 490 times or far more than that, still, the offer is out there. Come back. Be washed. And be sent out, and your past will be forgiven and remembered no more. Amen. Go and sin no more. That's one of the great admonitions.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.